This is an ABC podcast.
The Aboriginal flag is iconic. It means so much to First Nations Australians, and it's recognisable around the world, a symbol of Aboriginal culture and identity. Now, after a long fight and a huge Free the Flag movement, it belongs to all Australians. Hey, it's Dave Marchesian. On the Hack Podcast, we're breaking this down. What's the future of the flag? Also coming up, Tonga's deadly volcanic explosion and tsunami. It happened more than a week ago, but we're only now starting to find out just how much devastation it's caused.
Hack, the way that we like to position ourselves is that we are here to showcase the survival of the culture
on Triple J.
Tomorrow is January 26th. It's the Australia Day national public holiday. That means a lot of people will have the day off, but it's still marked in very different ways. For many First Nations people, it's a day of mourning. It's not Australia Day. It's Survival Day or Invasion Day. And for a growing number of people, it's a day that marks the beginning of the cultural destruction that started when Europeans arrived and claimed this country as their own. And everywhere across Australia, there are young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who are forced to deal with this conflict, how they feel about the day, and how their friends and other people do. Hack reporter and Bundjalung man AJ Williams is one of those young people, and he decided to have a chat with his mates.
Ah, the 26th of January. Back at it again with the debate that stops the nation. It's a day that many non-Indigenous people celebrate with mates, on boats, with beers and barbecues.
January 26th, obviously Australia Day. I mean, I've always been just grown up celebrating it, like just up beers, barbecue, beach, you know, just a normal Australian thing. Like,
normally start drinking early because it's a day off. Drink and talk shit with my mates.
Have a drink with the boys, barbecue, you know, traditional Australian things, I guess, in a way.
Well, actually, it's only been a thing since 1994, so it's not much of a tradition. First Nations people have had traditions here for over 60,000 years. And trust me, I love to party as much as the next person. Indigenous people have celebrated this country for millennia. But this ain't the day to do it. As a proud Bundjalung man, this day means a whole lot more than getting pissed with mates. It cuts deeper for Indigenous people and a growing amount of non-Indigenous people too. 26th of January, also known as Survival or Invasion Day, marks a day of mourning, sadness and hurt for a lot of Indigenous people. It's a day that marks the start of an invasion for First Nations people who were killed, black women raped and babies' heads used as soccer balls. Things we just can't forget about. My experience on Survival or Invasion Day is opening up Instagram and seeing a lot of my non-Indigenous mates partying and celebrating a day that has a very dark history. Each year this day rolls around, it reminds us that the arrival of the First Fleet is the most important story, and the 60,000 plus years of Indigenous culture means nothing. I decided to give my mate Braden a call about the history of January 26th. When Aboriginal people describe it as Survival Day, how does that make you feel? Like, what do you think about that?
Invasion Day or Survival Day, it's kind of hard because you don't want to celebrate those terms at all whatsoever. It's a bit of a touchy subject.
You celebrate Australia Day, so when you're out celebrating and, you know, having the time of your lives with mates, when there's some people that are mourning a day that represents the loss of land, a death of their ancestors and years of trauma, what do you think?
I believe, like, you should have a full understanding of what happened on this day. It is a hard thing because some people are celebrating a day where we're here, we're Australia, and then some people are mourning a day where they've lost Australia in a term. So I do recommend, if anyone wants to know, get out there, try to find some local like First Peoples in the community and have a good chat to them. Like, I dare say they'll be very willing to speak to you on behalf of their ancestors.
Yeah, so what's your message to people on Australia Day or Jan 26?
I think this term celebrating as one has now come to a halt because I think we are one now. Like the two cultures have come together. It is still a very hard time for the Indigenous culture, but I think we have come together very well, like, and we will still continue to grow to this day.
Yeah, it's a good message. But for many Indigenous Australians, that coming together will never happen unless the date is changed. Why? Because celebrating on a day that represents so much hurt, such pain and loss, simply isn't one that can be unified. I spend the 26th of January the way most Indigenous people spend it, going to community events and surrounding yourself with close family and friends to come together and celebrate the longest living continuous culture in the world. There is still so much learning we can do as a nation, and in order for us to properly come together as one and celebrate as one, we need to listen and learn together.
Hack on Triple J.
AJ Williams with that very personal story, and we thank AJ for telling it. Mortimer in Cranbourne North on the text line. Ah, Australia Day, another divisive Howard legacy. Thanks a bunch, Johnny. Another person says, feel lucky that my national company allows us to choose to work tomorrow as protest. Is it enough? Well, the Aboriginal flag is easily one of the most recognisable symbols of Australia. A yellow circle, the sun, the red bottom representing the earth, and a black top symbolising the Aboriginal people of Australia. But even though we all know it, it hasn't been free for everyone to use. And you might remember the artist who designed it held the copyright for the flag, and for years there have been fights over its use, and it led to that huge campaign to free the flag. Well, that's happened. The federal government's announced it's paid $20 million to secure the copyright, and it means anyone will be able to use it. You can put it on clothes, you can paint it on sports grounds, on websites, artworks. I want to know what you think of that. What does the flag mean to you? Let me know. 0439 757 555. Gunditjmara woman Laura Thompson owns Clothing The Gap, which makes clothes and other merch that features the Aboriginal flag. And she was one of those threatened with legal action and led to her setting up the Free the Flag campaign. Laura's with us now. G'day, Laura.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. This is a huge day for you, I would think. It's really big news and something that a lot of people have been fighting for a while. How do you feel about it?
Look, I was celebrated last night when I first heard about it, and this morning we can't get the smile off our face. We're so excited we finally freed the flag after more than 2 years of advocacy.
Yeah, I mean, the deal that the federal government secured means $20 million has been paid out to a few different licence holders. Do you think that that was a good deal that the government did?
Well, I feel like, you know, the Aboriginal flag is a piece of public property and it was privately owned. Community want to be able to use the flag freely. It's unfortunate that we're in this situation. Harold Thomas, the artist behind the flag, he was compensated for his artwork. He's had to pay out the previous license holders in order to free the flag. So unfortunately, that amount of money was just, I guess, a symptom of the copyright issue.
We've heard a lot about the issues that big organisations like the AFL and the NRL had with using the flag, but I wonder what kind of impact it was having on community groups, like smaller groups who, you know, just wanted to use it for themselves. Was that a big problem as well?
Well, I think people are surprised by that. Like, we look at the AFL and we go, oh my God, it's missing from, you know, the centre circle in the ground. But we have to think about all the grassroots community group who also have to pay to put an Aboriginal flag on their sports uniform. So this not only impacted our major sporting codes, but our grassroots community groups, our Aboriginal medical services who had to pay to use the flag. And today, none, you know, our sporting codes nor our grassroots have to pay to use the flag anymore.
And Laura, did we see a drop in the flag's usage in recent years because of all of these legal threats? When all that stuff was making the news, was it noticeable that the flag wasn't being used as much as it had been in previous years?
That was actually one of the sad outcomes of the Free the Flag campaign, and especially as it started to drag on and the length of their campaign, we noticed dramatically that less and less people were using the Aboriginal flag, and we had a whole lot of alternatives to use, or using the colours or just the shapes, but not the shapes and colours combined, like the proud Aboriginal flag that we used to fly before. So, you know, now we can use that, and I'm so excited to see it return to the community.
There's obviously a lot of people thinking about the timing of this announcement. Whenever the government announces something big, everyone looks at the timing and they wonder, is this a bit of a distraction in the lead up to January 26th? A lot of people are saying that. Do you have an opinion on that, Laura?
Look, we've waited and we've been advocating for 2.5 years to free the flag. I think, you know, today we did rejoice and so did lots of Aboriginal people, but tomorrow, Invasion Day, it is not a date to celebrate. We won't be celebrating tomorrow, and we'll be checking out, and it's a day of mourning for Aboriginal people. And I think the same for mob. Like, you know, we're grateful and we're happy that we've got our flag back today, but that's not going to change the way we feel about tomorrow.
I'm wondering, with the flag, the Prime Minister said it needs to be presented in a respectful and dignified way. Do you think that's an important point to make, or it's going to have any kind of impact on its use in the future?
I think, you know, with the flag and the copyright being owned by the federal government, it sits as part of the Flags Act. So part of being able to use the flag is that you treat the flag with integrity and respect, and you only reproduce it in those ways. So I'm confident that the Aboriginal flag will continue to be respected, and Harold Thomas, the artist, will continue to be acknowledged for creating an iconic symbol that Aboriginal people loved and adopted.
And what are you hoping will happen now? I'm imagining you're expecting a huge boost in interest and visibility of the flag. I mean, it is one of the symbols that people not only here in Australia but around the world recognise that as a symbol of Aboriginal culture. Do you think that that's just going to explode now and we're going to see more people recognising it around the world?
I hope so. I mean, that would be an incredible outcome for people to sort of look at Australia and go, who are the First Nations people, and learn more, you know, about us. And, you know, for Aboriginal people, now that we've freed the flag, we have consumer choice. We're not stuck in where we have to buy our Aboriginal flag only from one non-Indigenous company. We can choose. We've got consumer choice now. So there's going to be a lot more Aboriginal flags in the world, and Aboriginal people are going to have a lot more choice with who they buy it from, and that can only be a good thing.
And I guess, like, on social media as well, we'll start seeing it pop up. Instagram, it's going to be a thing now, hopefully.
I hope so. I'm hanging for the emoji. and I think so many of the mob are.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Laura Thompson from Clothing the Gap. A huge day for so many people and a huge fight for you that's gone on for years. So thank you very much for taking the time to join us on Hack.
No worries.
Now, we've got a lot of comments coming in, some people saying about time the flag was given back to the community. This is a huge win. And some other texts from people about Australia Day, Invasion Day, January 26th. If you search through the internet, someone says, you'll find posters of Australia Day on a number of other days, including one in July. So it's not a long-held tradition. And Sean from Bendigo, you say, as a non-Indigenous person, changing the date is a no-brainer in my opinion. If we're going to do that, though, we should also focus on incorporating Aboriginal culture into our education systems.
Hack.
Holy shit.
Satellite images capturing the moment of the eruption. A huge plume of smoke and ash billowing out over the region.
Triple J.
Yeah, those sounds you just heard weren't gunshots or fireworks. They were a volcanic explosion hundreds of times more powerful than an atomic bomb. Just over a week ago, tens of thousands of people woke up to a normal, beautiful day on the island paradise they call home, Tonga. But just hours later, that eruption, then a tsunami, destroyed homes and businesses, killed at least three people, and left the people of Tonga and surrounding islands traumatised. Communication blackouts mean a lot of anxious family back here in Australia still don't know just how bad the damage is and whether their loved ones are safe. Ellie Grounds has been speaking to people in Tonga.
It just looks like a bomb went off at the resort. I can't describe it any other way, coupled with, you know, the damage from the tsunami.
The last time Alan Burling saw the resort his family has run in Tonga for more than 40 years, it looked like paradise.
You know, palm trees, blue sea, crystal clear waters. I think that's the most accurate picture I can paint of what it's like at home.
But not anymore.
Absolutely destroying everything. Like, there's not even any There's no houses left. There's only the foundations, which is buried under sand. It's, you know, covered in volcanic ash.
10 days ago, an underwater volcano about 65 kilometres north of Tonga's main island, Tongatapu, erupted, covering the country in ash and triggering 15-metre tsunami waves across its islands. Tonga's government reckons the ash and tsunami affected 4 out of 5 people. The blast damaged the underwater cable that provides Tongans with phone and internet connection, so no one could find out what was going on there.
Oh, it was horrible. It was the worst 2 days. I wouldn't, you know, ever wish it upon anyone.
26-year-old Alan lives in New Zealand now, and it took a while before he could get onto his sister Moana, who runs the family resort on Tongatapu, and she told him how they escaped the tsunami.
So they had to run through the bushes, through the back of the resort along with the staff, and had to climb some trees to get away from the waves that were washing through inland. And then from that holler, Moana's husband actually had a phone and got a hold of a family friend who managed to pick them up off the main road, which is about 1 kilometre inland. And from there, they were able to rush to safety.
It took 5 days for international humanitarian aid to get there, but the Tongan branch of the Red Cross were able to respond straight away.
Then our volunteers and staff were able to get water, because immediately people are not used to ash, and ash have covered the water tanks. Very few people have taken off the gutter or make sure that the water tanks were covered. So ash were going in everywhere. So there was a fear that this has been contaminated.
Drew Harveya is the vice president of Red Cross Tonga. He says the immediate priority was getting people access to clean drinking water, and now they're focusing on shelter. He reckons around 300 people from the outer islands were made homeless and have moved to the capital, Nuku'alofa. But recovery isn't easy with all the ash.
The ash is overwhelming everyone. We haven't had the experience with ash, snow covering the island, and especially roofs and drinking water.
Alan's family is still rattled by what happened to their resort. While they've experienced cyclones and tidal surges before, it doesn't compare to the damage that was caused by the volcanic eruption and tsunami.
We've lost literally everything. They literally didn't have time to save, you know, anything from the resort. So it would literally be starting from nothing.
He thinks they will rebuild, but it's going to be expensive because their insurance won't cover them for the disaster.
Because of the regularity of natural disasters in the islands, they don't cover that. So we've literally lost everything and don't have any financial assistance.
He started a GoFundMe page to help raise money for the resort and its staff. And his family in New Zealand has shipped over donations of things like food, water and clothing. Australia has already sent 3 aid flights to Tonga, and a naval ship with more supplies was meant to arrive tomorrow. But a COVID outbreak on board means it's been paused for now. Drew Harveya says recovery will be slow, especially for those people whose islands were completely wiped out.
So I'll probably say 1 year or more. It could be a 2-year thing if we plan well to make sure that those are relocated also up on their own 2 feet and be able to take care of themselves.
It's been, you know, very big toll on my mum and dad, as, you know, they resorts a very close place to them, and for us all, it's, you know, our childhood. We all grew up there, lived in Tonga and at the resort, so it's yeah, it's been pretty devastating.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that story. And if anyone wants to help Alan's family and the staff from their resort who've lost everything, you can go find their GoFundMe page by searching Support Hatafu Beach Resort. It's up there.
Hack. If people aren't staying at home, then they're in your face, possibly giving you COVID.
On Triple J. Well, if you've been affected by COVID over the past few years, chances are you've had to rely on some kind of government support during the pandemic, whether it was JobKeeper, JobSeeker, other disaster payments, maybe all of them. But applying for that kind of help is anything but easy. So many young people have found that out over the past couple of years. Maybe you struggled. Was it too hard and did you just give up? Get in touch, 0439 75 7555. Daisy Hooper from regional South Australia found out just how hard it was when the hangover that her friends assured her she had turned out to be COVID. Reporter Georgia Roberts spoke to her about her experience.
I started feeling sick on the 2nd of January, like really sick in the morning. All my friends were trying to kind of talk me out of my mindset that I had COVID, and they were saying, you've just been in Rome, you've been partying. And I thought, no, this actually feels different. I actually feel really, really sick. So I knew from the get-go that, you know, I wasn't feeling right.
As a casual at an Adelaide marketing agency, the 23-year-old doesn't get sick leave. And the day after receiving a positive PCR test, she needed money.
Like, I've got, you know, rent that I have to pay, and I haven't worked. Well, because it was also Christmas and New Year, I had those pretty much two weeks off from working anyway, so that was unpaid, and then another 10 days, so that's nearly a month of no working.
Federal government data shows those aged 20 to 29 make up the highest number of COVID-19 cases right now. And of course, 20-somethings make up a pretty large part of the casual workforce. Daisy heard about the federal government's pandemic leave disaster payment, so she decided to go for it. 12 days later, the money appeared in her bank account. While she was waiting for it, though, she took to her Insta story to see if anyone else was having problems.
I think I counted it was about 70-ish responses to my kind of question box on Instagram. And, yeah, it was pretty interesting. I reckon, like, 85% of the responses were, like, kind of saying the same thing as me, that they applied ages ago, have heard nothing, or lots and lots of responses of people being like, I don't even know how to apply, like, thank you for sharing this kind of, because I shared more information about how to do it. So that was interesting to know that, like, people in the same boat as me.
The financial relief provided by the federal government during the pandemic has switched up from state to state, as has the criteria for isolating, testing and close exposure. Whoever gets the pandemic leave disaster payment has changed with all that.
Basically, I wasn't working full-time throughout most of the pandemic, so I don't have a lot of money. So I've been on JobKeeper for a bit, and then when that finished off, I applied for JobSeeker. I've also had the pandemic leave previously when Melbourne was a hotspot and in lockdown last year.
That's casual retail employee Megan Sinclair. She went into ISO last week after one of her housemates tested positive for COVID-19. Without any type of leave, the 27-year-old found herself back on the Centrelink website looking for some help with cash. This time, though, she felt a little bit lost.
It honestly took me a bit to find the correct form. And even then, I was like, I don't know if this is the right form. It doesn't tell you what to do with it after you get the form and fill it out. I couldn't tell you. I haven't heard from Centrelink yet. I'm just winging it, really, and seeing what other people have done. Just waiting to see if that's the correct thing, the correct form, the correct way to do it.
Services Australia, the government department that provides the pandemic leave disaster payment, last week announced a new way for customers to apply for it. General Manager Hank Jongen hopes the new process will streamline applications, meaning you might not have to wait as long as Daisy did.
The new platform that we've introduced means that people will be able to lodge a claim online through MyGov. And that will not only make it easier for them to claim, but also make it easier for us to process.
The new claim process will only be available to those who began isolation on or after the 18th of January. Melbourne retail worker Megan is kind of worried for her friends in hospo and retail.
It's not promising because this is probably only the start of what's going to be happening for the next 2 months, 3 months, is that workers are going to be isolated, especially when you work in retail and hospitality. You're more or less, you're out there, you're talking to people. And if people aren't, you know, staying at home, then they're in your face, possibly giving you COVID.
Hack on Triple J.
Georgia Roberts with that story. Thanks, Georgia. And let me know, what's been your experience trying to get hold of financial support during this pandemic? Someone says on the text line, 12 days wait for a government payment. That's very quick. I don't know. We're hearing people waiting long times, struggling to get by without the money. give me a call, 1300 055536, or send a message 0439 757 555. For more on this, I'm joined by Aidan McCarthy. He's a community lawyer in Melbourne, and he knows a bit about this and some of the challenges that young people have been going through. Aidan, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Now, young people have been talking about this for ages, just having so much trouble trying to access this support to help them get by, pay their rent, pay for groceries. Do you think that there've been a lot of young people missing out because of these complicated applications?
Yeah, look, I guess I have concerns about it. I haven't seen any casework, or I haven't had any clients come through who've had these issues, but what we've seen over the last couple of years is that there's been a real departure from what we'd like to see from Services Australia and from Centrelink specifically in providing the assistance to people that they need. And in the recent increase in cases and with tests being so difficult to get, we think that the circumstances are now different to what this pandemic leave disaster payment is really designed for.
What do we think about young people missing out on money? When we talk about that, you also are worried about young people being overpaid. You say that there could be some issues there.
Yeah, that's right. And the one big reason for that is that if you're receiving an income support payment any sort of Centrelink payment, your job seeker, AusStudy, those sorts of things, youth allowance, and also parental leave pay, you're not eligible for the pandemic leave disaster payment. You might be eligible for, there's another sort of payment, national health emergency crisis payment, but you aren't eligible for the disaster payment. The other thing is that Centrelink takes their obligation to chase people for money that they are overpaid really seriously. And because the pandemic leave disaster payment process has been sort of cobbled together as things have worsened, I suppose that our concern would be that people aren't going to be sure about the sort of evidence they need to keep, for example. And I would expect that it would be no surprise to myself and my colleagues and anyone who's dealt with Centrelink before that in a few months' time or in a few years' time, Centrelink will go over the books and make sure that the people who got the pandemic leave disaster payment were meant to. And so the main thing I'm worried about is young people or people who haven't dealt with Centrelink before not keeping the evidence that they need to make sure that they can prove they were entitled down the track.
Yeah, well, we've seen the devastation that causes with overpayment scandals in the past and robo-debt and all the rest of it. What needs to be done to simplify the process? Are there some simple things that can happen to make this a lot easier?
The process has changed this week, as the Chief of Services Australia said before, and I hope that addresses some of the issues. I suppose the idea of not having to supply the evidence at the start means you get on easier. I think that's the theory anyway. As we've heard, people are still not getting on very easily at all. But I suppose what I would like to see is Centrelink being more proactive in getting that information, getting that evidence from people so that they know that they've done all the bits that they need to do to get the payment that they're receiving.
And where can people go if they need help sorting this stuff out? Like, often people just won't know who to turn to or where to get some assistance to fill out all these forms.
Yeah, there's not a lot of help for people to apply, unfortunately, but Centrelink's disaster line is probably the easiest place to start. Centrelink have a disaster line that they use for natural disasters and for things like COVID. I suppose the if you have a problem, you don't know it until it's arisen. And so normally where we would need people to come is to go to a community legal centre and get the legal advice they need.
Great. Aidan McCarthy, thanks so much for coming on Hack. Appreciate your time. That's all we've got time for today. We'll be back on Thursday with another edition of Hack. See you then. Hack.